I consent to this interview being used in a public archive by Northeastern.
So could you start by talking a little bit about your regular job and if your daily routine has been changed in any ways by the pandemic? Could you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. And so I'm a primary care physician, general internist. I do both outpatient and inpatient care, as well as have some other administrative or leadership roles with that within Mass General. And in terms of day-to-day life, it's been pretty dramatically altered. I see patients pretty much every single day in the office. It's the bulk of the care that I have delivered over 20 years now. And just the fact that we really haven't been able to see people in the office has been a dramatic shift. In addition, I have been someone who has also taken care of my own patients in the hospital, and am used to being the attending of record for those patients. And with the pandemic and the way that the hospital had to restructure, even the ability for longitudinal primary care doctors or others to go in the hospital and see their patients has been pretty curtailed because of the need to conserve the protective equipment and try to prevent any spread and the infection control issues. So even with the hospital care, it's trying to deliver some of that virtually. So pretty dramatically changed. Yeah.
Right. Could you talk a little bit more about those structural changes and some of the precautions that have been implemented in the hospital?
Yeah, I mean, so the hospital, really has completely restructured, the way patients flow through the hospital to try to put all of, at least, up until now, and I think this is going to change as some of the, rates of hospitalization ease, but certainly during the peak of the pandemic and the surge, we've had to really restructure how patients are evaluated, special precautions for those who are either, been found to be positive for COVID or suspected of it, and moving through different floors of the hospital to, when they're in different stages of diagnosis of COVID, to try to ensure that, the PPE is conserved. You put people near each other who, or you try to keep people segregated who may have it versus may not have it. Just the sheer volume, of people coming in the hospital with this particular illness is unlike anything I've ever seen before. We have almost 1,000 beds or more than 1,000 beds. And at the highest number, there were, 400 people in the hospital with COVID or suspected of having COVID, which is unlike any other kind of disease condition that we have. We normally have 5 intensive care units. We had to develop upwards of 10 intensive care units. Staff got reassigned and redeployed, especially nursing. There's tremendous strain on nursing resources. Patients aren't allowed to have visitors in the hospital. That puts an enormous emotional strain on top of already an emotionally challenging situation. It's pretty much affected every aspect of care. And then, of course, there's the entire segment of what's been called somewhat elective care that's been delayed or deferred, and how that's impacted people's lives as well. So it's unlike anything I think anyone's ever seen before.
Right. Do you have any memorable patient experiences, either directly or indirectly related to the pandemic, that you could share?
I certainly have had, my share of patients been diagnosed with it and hospitalized. I've had certainly lost several patients, to it. In some ways, people that were already, fairly ill. And so in some ways, not overly surprising in terms of what happened to them if they got sick, either from this or even from a regular pneumonia or potentially even the flu. So I would say not a lot of kind of unexpected deaths, but just a lot of fear and anxiety. And then a couple of younger people who've gotten it and gotten, pretty sick from it. They did okay in the end, but it was a little dicey for a while as to whether or not they were going to be okay. And someone you would never expect a virus to cause any kind of a problem in. you know, I think there are a couple of individuals, you know, who, again, just being alone and in the hospital and sort of dying in the hospital has been challenging, very challenging. I think, as I said, the nurses have been incredible in trying to figure out ways to allow family to FaceTime or to do other kind of virtual end of life care. But just very heart wrenching when, you know, you really can't go through those traditional, you know, grieving processes even right before death and right afterwards, you know, for the families especially, but also hard to not be able to really see your patients, you know, when they're going through something like this directly. You know, the phone and video is, you know, as good as you can do in terms of a substitute, but it's not the same as you know, being there, you know, in person and holding someone's hand. It just isn't.
A lot of the doctors that I've interviewed have talked about that kind of indirect patient care as being one of the biggest challenges of working during the pandemic. Would you say that that's the same for you?
It is. It is a challenge. It's great for certain issues, and you know, I think it's something that, you know, healthcare has been slow to adopt in terms of technology and being able to deliver, you know, care a little bit more virtually. And I think there are certain issues, problems, conditions for which, you know, a phone call or a video visit, you know, work great. Not everything has to come into the office, but I think even in those situations, you still do lose a little bit of something in the interaction, and you do lose a little bit of something in terms of just the interpersonal relationship. My personal feeling is that, you know, medicine and healthcare is all about relationships. It's you know, that's at the core of what we do, is have relationships with our patients that, you know, engender trust and understand what they want and need, as well as what we think they should do. And so I think you know, the more you put barriers in between that, or to a degree depersonalize it, we're on the bedrock of healthcare, which is the patient doctor relationship. So you know, I think it is a challenge. It's useful in a lot of ways. It definitely can be in some ways more efficient. In other ways, it's less efficient. You know, you try to deal with something over the phone or by video a couple times, and you really realize, no, you really do need to either examine them or send them for more testing, which when you would have seen them, you might not have otherwise done. So I think we're doing probably more testing and things than we might otherwise do, because you don't have the opportunity to examine them and you don't want to miss something. So it's mixed. It's mixed. And I think it's what we're learning is, while this does need to be probably a larger part of how we deliver care in the future, I don't think that people who are predicting, you know, half of all care will be virtual and delivered virtually, I don't see happening. I don't think that's the way we're going to go ultimately at all. But, you know, we'll see.
Right. Are there any common misconceptions that you hear about COVID, either among patients or even in the media?
I mean, I think the biggest one still is, and there's less of it, but this is, you know, a lot of people saying, well, this is kind of just a bad flu. What's the big deal? And it's not. It's not just a bad flu. It's something else entirely. You know, for one, we don't have any immunity to it. There's no real treatment for it, and you know, the mortality is much, much greater. We don't know what that's ultimately going to be, but I think that's still probably the biggest you know, misconception, is that this is just a bad flu season, and we shouldn't really worry about this too much. I think on the other end of the spectrum, you know, there are, you know, we have to be careful also to be balanced in how we do now approach moving forward. I think with what we've done up to now in terms of shutting everything down and trying to just sort out what this is and what it's going to look like and how we're going to respond to it. But now that I think we've gotten that under control, the numbers are coming down, and we figure out how to make sure we protect, you know, the most vulnerable. Who does this really impact? How can we sort of balance returning to some new normal life at the same time, you know, trying to minimize, you know, the spread of it? So I think we have to be careful not to also overdo it, because as a general internist, not just taking care of COVID, I also worry about, you know, the inability to deliver routine care that people do need as well. and not to put up too many barriers, you know, for people to actually be seen and cared for in a normal way.
Right.
You know, a lot of what's been done and what we've asked people to do isn't necessarily for themselves and their own safety per se, because, you know, we even do now that even though this is much more deadly than the flu, it, you know, and it's not the flu, like I said, the truth is the majority of people who do get sick and who do die from this are older, who have underlying health conditions. Right. So people who are young and healthy, the risk to them is tiny. And so much of what's been done is really for the greater good. It's a really, you know, amazing, you know, situation. It's the greater good to prevent spread, to prevent hospitals from being overwhelmed, to prevent, you know, those who are vulnerable from getting sick and dying from this, who we could avoid that. And so it is a hard balance, and it's you know, I think going to be increasingly challenging over the next, you know, year to 2 years as this drags on, you know, how to figure out how to protect the people who need to be protected, allow the people who are less vulnerable to be able to try to, you know, return to some semblance of normalcy. We can't just stop school forever, right? We can't stop work forever. So we do have to figure something out that balances all that. And it's going to be a little rocky over the right. next period of time while we sort that out.
Kind of relating to that, a lot of the doctors that I've interviewed have talked about the strength and sense of community among health professionals. Do you feel like that has translated to society, or do you feel like the pandemic has divided us more?
You know, I'm more of an optimist. I actually think what's happened in the healthcare side, you know, is incredibly inspirational. I think, and I think generally from what I see in society, I actually think it's amazing. I think, you know, as with all things social media related or news related, you know, they like to report a little bit more on the negative than the positive. That sells better, grabs headlines, you know, but I really think just the fact that the compliance in most places with most regulations, whether it's around stay-at-home orders or wearing masks or whatnot, is incredibly high. It's not 100%, of course. You know, there are people who are doing things they probably, you know, shouldn't do. But, you know, and it's all over the news when the, you know, people are going swimming or doing this or that at a party. But I think
right.
by and large, it feels like, at least up to now, 95% or more of the American public has done exactly what's been asked of them, if not more. And most of them, again, are doing it at their own personal sacrifice, whether it's financially, economically, personal freedom-wise, or even, you know, socially. And they're doing it even though they're probably not at high risk, but they're doing it, you know, to benefit others and to try to help others. And I think, you know, I just think we do tend to focus so much on the negative or so much on the few that don't, that we really do miss the bigger picture, which is, you know, most people, I think, are doing the right thing and want to do the right thing. So I think by and large, it's been much more inspirational than it has been, you know, disturbing in terms of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the emotional strain of working in a hospital during this time. Could you talk a little bit about the mental health resources, both for doctors and patients?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a pretty significant recognition early on that this is incredibly, you know, taxing, not just on the frontline workers who are directly caring for folks. There's that piece of it. But then, you know, there's even the folks who aren't able to work on the front lines, either because they're unable to, they have their own health risks, or they just work in an area of healthcare that's not directly related in any way to COVID and they don't have the skill set to. And you know, they're dealing with feelings of guilt and of not being able to participate. And, you know, most people do, I really believe, go into medicine and healthcare because they want to help other people in whatever way that is. And if they're not able to do that, it's challenging for them, you know, emotionally. So, you know, I think fortunately there has been a pretty significant recognition on that. I can only really speak to, you know, what's happening here at Mass General and, you know, the Partners Healthcare System, which I think there's been incredible attention and resources put into it to offer, you know, not just physicians, but nurses, staff, everybody, both emotional support, financial support if needed, even. And so I think we're very, you know, fortunate to work in a system like this that really does value its team.
Yeah, that's really amazing. I've heard a lot about what MGH has been doing, and it mm-hmm. sounds like they've been very on top of things.
It's been amazing, and I also would say that I think the incredible outpouring of support from the community, whether it's people sending food to the hospital or to practices, or whether it's just you see the signs up, thank you healthcare workers all over towns. Right. You hear these messages from public figures, sports figures, entertainment figures, thanking healthcare workers. I think it's just incredibly gratifying. My wife's gotten just random, messages on her Facebook or from random friends she hasn't even talked to saying, I know your husband's a doctor and, thank him for what he does, stuff like that. It means a lot. It really does. It's really appreciated by everybody.
Are there any things that you feel could have been done differently, either in the hospital or in society, to prepare for or respond to COVID?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the greatest failures looking back on this, is the slow response related to mainly to testing and how we just, it took us, way too long to get our act together and still even in terms of having widespread access to testing for both, for mostly for acute, diagnosis. And I think that, certainly let this spread much faster and more widely than it needed to early on. And I think also, the lack of infrastructure around our kind of contact tracing and epidemiology, to be able to figure out, how to isolate people early on. And so instead, we had to do, again, what other countries did do as well. It's not just the US in terms of, these blanket lockdowns. Which paralyzed everything, even in areas where there was very little, diagnosis of disease or transmission, mainly because you didn't know what was going on in the location. So I think that's, an enormous, failure across the entire system, of healthcare and at every level, I think, in terms of that level of preparedness on testing, especially contact tracing, PPE to a degree, certainly in terms of, seeing what was happening overseas and thinking about, ramping up manufacturing and other things, more rapidly. I think just getting the word out as to what was going to be coming. We had a bit of a leeway in terms of timing of seeing what happened in China, what happened in Italy, and I think we just reacted too slowly across the board.
Are there any lessons that you feel you'll take away from working during the pandemic?
There's a few. I mean, I would say not that I ever lost it, but certainly, as I said, reinstilled my, faith in our each other. And as I said, I think overall the response on it, has been incredibly inspiring. And the work that we do. I will say it definitely opened my eyes up to disparities, in our healthcare system. Just having worked in different locations and just seeing the different challenges that, some of our inner city, areas face versus, suburban areas, the level of ability for people to even understand the health literacy, the ability to even socially distance, the ability to not work versus going to work no matter what, because you're living so paycheck to paycheck. I mean, I think it really did expose more directly a lot of those issues that we are dealing with, and stuff that, you might not have otherwise, or I wouldn't have necessarily otherwise seen working in one practice versus another.
Mm-hmm. And then you talked about the shift to the virtual or telehealth visits. Are there any other ways that you see this impacting healthcare in the future?
I hope that it'll be a bit of a catalyst to try to have us focus more on health and wellness. I mean, I think, we do recognize, or people are recognizing certainly, that a lot of the people who are affected by this most severely are those who have underlying health conditions that are manageable or preventable in a lot of ways by better lifestyle, diet, exercise, you know, weight management. A lot of people are more vulnerable, you know, are people who are, you know, have obesity issues, have diabetes, have heart disease. I mean, so many underlying lung disease, so many of these conditions we always know and are to a degree, I wouldn't say 100% preventable, but lifestyle, but certainly we can greatly mitigate the impact of them, you know, by a greater focus on health and wellness, on prevention, and, you know, even addressing disparities in those areas. And so I think I'm hoping that, you know, the longer term recognition that if we put more effort and resource into these things, that will, you know, not that will save lives down the line, and not just save lives, it, you know, there's an economic impact of that as well. There's a lot of evidence that it actually makes good policy to do these things. It's not just the right thing to do, but you know, you can really prevent a lot of healthcare complications, expense, and needs by promoting healthier lifestyle.
Right. The doctor that I was talking to from the community health center was talking about the fact that a lot of her patients do suffer from obesity and those kind of underlying health conditions because of a lot of those social determinants of health and the nutrition that they're able to access. So do you think that could change in any ways because of policies?
I hope so. I do. I really, really hope so. It should. I mean, no question. And this isn't conservative Democrat Republican issue. This is
right.
This is, you know, sense for everybody. I mean, it just makes sense. Everybody recognizes this question of how to get there, in terms of how do you help convince people? What kind of resources do you put into our public health system to, you know, make it available for people to eat healthier, live healthier, exercise more, you know, reduce smoking, reduce alcohol, all the things that we need to do to promote a healthy lifestyle, which does prevent disease down the line, which does save money down the line on the system. And so I hope so. That I think one of the big worries, you know, that I have and why I'm not overly optimistic, despite the, you know, level of, not just because of the level of partisanship and the likelihood of getting any kind of real healthcare reforms done to our system, is also the, you know, all these things do come with an upfront cost. When you really invest in, you know, public health measures, you invest in wellness measures, you have to spend money now to get a benefit, you know, down the line, 5-10 years from now, in terms of preventing problems from happening, preventing the complications of diabetes and obesity and heart disease and cancer and everything. And so, you know, in the near term, when we're, you know, already spending so much money on, you know, stabilizing the economy and all the things that are going on now, I'm not overly optimistic that once the crisis passes, there's going to be a big appetite for another large investment in public health infrastructure. Unfortunately, as much as it makes sense and as much as it will, you know, is what we need to do, I don't know that that's something that's, you know, in any way realistic on a political level to expect.
Right. All right. Well, that is everything I have. Thank you again.
My pleasure. Anytime. And if you have follow-up stuff or you need any more, let me know.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks for doing this. Take care.